Welcome back to Open Secrets. I'm your host, Dr. Dan Stanislawski, and we have another wonderful episode for you. This is actually episode 7, and the book we'll be going through is called The CIA and the World of Arts and Letters, The Cultural Cold War. However, before we get there, Open Secrets now has some sponsors, so hooray for that. But the first sponsor is Alternative Health. Alternative Health in Grand Forks is your go-to trusted medical providers that offer therapeutic benefits of cannabis and are qualified to prescribe medical marijuana. Dr. Charlotte Ewalls is a licensed medical professional in both North Dakota and Minnesota. You do not need a referral, and she'll assist patients with a natural and holistic approach for pain management and increased quality of life. Now offering medical marijuana assessment for North Dakota and Minnesota residents in conjunction with alternative therapy referrals. For more information, check out alternativehealthgf.com, email info@alternativehealthgf.com, call 701-317-1747, make sure and call for an appointment. They're in the Happy Harry's complex on Gateway Drive in Grand Forks. For a better life, it's Alternative Health in Grand Forks. So, The Cultural Cold War by Francis Stoner Saunders. This book was originally published in England in 1999 under the title Who Paid the Piper? CIA and the Cultural Cold War. Francis Stoner Saunders is an Oxford graduate in history, and she was a filmmaker who turned into a very successful writer. And this book, she won some awards for this book. And I think you'll see why after we start going through it. One thing I'll say about this book in Frances Stoner Saunders is she is very meticulous in her references and her documentation of what she's talking about. And interestingly, with this book, she tried several times to do Freedom of Information Act requests to get documents from the CIA. And she was told that, you know, she could go that route and it would end up costing her approximately $30,000. And that doesn't even guarantee that she'd get these documents. So there is some, you know, lack of prima facie evidence from the Central Intelligence Agency documents themselves, but you'll see nonetheless, she parsed this together through extensive travel, extensive interviewing of the people involved. And it's, I think, a very important historical work. So without further ado, I will get into the CIA and the Cultural Cold War. You can see this pretty cool title. I don't know, I'll say this, the publisher of this book had a very interesting format. It's a very large book and it was interesting to lug this around all the time. But let's get into the intro here. And I really like this quote that this starts out with. It says, "The way to carry out good propaganda is never to appear to be carrying it out at all." And that is certainly the truth. So here we go. During the height of the Cold War, the U.S. government committed vast resources to a secret program of cultural propaganda in Western Europe. A central feature of this program was to advance the claim that it did not exist. It was managed in great secrecy by America's espionage arm, the Central Intelligence Agency. The centerpiece of this covert campaign was the Congress for Cultural Freedom, run by the CIA agent Michael Josselson from 1950 till 1967. Its achievements, not least its duration, were considerable. At its peak, the Congress for Cultural Freedom had offices in 35 countries, employed dozens of personnel, published over 20 prestige magazines, held art exhibitions, owned a news and feature service, organized high-profile international conferences, and rewarded musicians and artists with prizes in public performances. Its mission was to nudge the intelligentsia of Western Europe away from its lingering fascination with Marxism and communism towards a view more accommodating of the American way. Drawing on extensive, highly influential network of intelligence personnel, political strategists, the corporate establishment, and the old CIA ties of the Ivy League universities, The incipient CIA started from 1947 to build a consortium whose double task it was to inoculate the world against the contagion of communism and to ease the passage of American foreign policy interests abroad. The result was a remarkably tight network of people who worked alongside the agency to promote an idea that the world needed a Pax Americana, a new age of enlightenment, and what would be called the American century. The consortium, which the CIA built up, consisting of what Henry Kissinger described as an aristocracy dedicated to the service of this nation on behalf of principles beyond partisanship, was the hidden weapon in America's Cold War struggle, a weapon which, in the cultural field, had extensive fallout. Whether they liked it or not, whether they knew it or not, there were few writers, poets, artists, historians, scientists, or critics in post-war Europe whose names were not in some way linked to this covert enterprise. Unchallenged, undetected for over 20 years, America's spying establishment operated a sophisticated, substantially endowed cultural front in the West, for the West, in the name of freedom of expression. Defining the Cold War as a battle for men's minds, it stockpiled a vast arsenal of cultural weapons, journals, books, conferences, seminars, art exhibitions, concerts, awards. Membership of this consortium included an assorted group of former radicals and leftist intellectuals whose faith in Marxism and communism had been shattered by evidence of Stalinist totalitarianism. Emerging from the pink decade of the 1930s, mourned by Arthur Koestler, and we'll get into some of Arthur Koestler's books too, as an abortive revolution of the spirit, a misfired renaissance, a false dawn of history, their disillusionment was attended by a readiness to join a new consensus, to affirm a new order which would substitute for the spent forces of the past. The tradition of the radical dissenter, where intellectuals took it upon themselves to probe myths, interrogate institutional prerogative, and disturb the complacency of power, was suspended in favor of supporting the American proposition. And I'll say this too, I mean, this tradition of radical dissenter, where intellectuals took it upon themselves to probe myths, interrogate institutional prerogative, and disturb the complacency of power, was suspended in favor of supporting, blindly supporting the American proposition. This is even more prevalent now. No one does this. Think about all the establishment powers, especially from the government, that people just blindly nod their heads in agreement with. That is the antithesis of intellectualism and the antithesis of intellectual freedom. And we're starting to see here, we're going to uncover some of the origins of this. Endorsed and subsidized by powerful institutions, this non-communist group became as much a cartel in the intellectual life of the West as communism had been a few years earlier, and it included many of the same people. The extent to which America's spying establishment extended its reach into the cultural affairs of its Western allies, acting as unacknowledged facilitator to a broad range of creative activity, positioning intellectuals and their work like chess pieces to be played in the great game, remains one of the Cold War's most provocative legacies. Amongst intellectual circles in America and Western Europe, there persists a readiness to accept as true that the CIA was merely interested in extending the possibilities for free and democratic cultural expression. We simply help people to say what they would have been saying anyway. Again, this is rationalization, right? They're rationalizing their activities here. Goes this blank check line of defense. If the beneficiaries of CIA funds were ignorant of the fact, the argument goes, and if their behavior was consequently unmodified, then their independence as critical thinkers could not have been affected. But official documents relating to the cultural Cold War systematically undermine this myth of altruism. The individuals and institutions subsidized by the CIA were expected to perform as part of a broad campaign of persuasion of a propaganda war in which propaganda was defined as any organized effort or movement to disseminate information or a particular doctrine by means of news, special arguments, or appeals designed to influence the thoughts and actions of any given group. A vital constituent of this effort was psychological warfare, which was defined as the planned use by a nation of propaganda and activities other than combat, which communicate ideas and information intended to influence the opinions, attitudes, emotions, and behavior of foreign groups in ways that will support the achievement of national aims. Further, the most effective kind of propaganda was defined as the kind where the subject moves in the direction you desire for reasons which he believes to be his own. And that sounds a lot like stuff that's happening today. I'm going to finish quickly reading this and then we'll talk about that. And this is, I think this is Francis Stoner Saunders talking now. Clearly, by camouflaging its investment, the CIA acted on the supposition that its blandishments would be refused if offered openly. She asked, what kind of freedom can be advanced by such deception? Did this not risk producing, instead of freedom, a kind of freedom, false freedom, where people think they are acting freely, when in fact they are bound to forces over which they have no control? And again, I put here in columns, this is on high octane now with behavioral insights teams, and that sort of function where they are dictating people's reality, giving them a pretense of free thought and individualism, when reality, the conclusions they're coming to, the thoughts that they are thinking, are systematically and scientifically implanted in their minds. So we're going to get into the history of the CIA's involvement in these type of operations. So we're going to talk, you just briefly mention some of the main characters here. I mentioned Josselson at the beginning. Josselson stayed on in Berlin with the American military government as cultural affairs officer, then with the State Department and the U.S. High Commission as a public affairs officer. So already there's, within the U.S. military, there's cultural affairs officers and psychological operations already going on to manipulate culture. Another one we're going to skip over here is Nabokov. Nabokov joined the Morale Division of the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey Unit in Germany, where he met psychological warfare personnel and subsequently got a job in the Information Control Division alongside his old acquaintance, Josselson. As a composer, Nabokov was assigned to the music section, where he was expected to establish good psychological and cultural weapons with which to destroy Nazism and promote a genuine desire for a democratic Germany. Again, so he's using music as a cultural tool to destroy Nazism. His task was to eject the Nazis from German musical life and license those German musicians, giving them the right to exercise their profession, whom we believe to be clean Germans, and to control government programs of German concerts and see to it that they would not turn into nationalist manifestations. All right. So again, so this is just some of the major players. We're going to get one more major player, and really, we're not going to talk too much about them. Just making you aware that these people have specific talents involving in some cultural aspects, and they're already military men, some of them already with psychological operations divisions. Again, if you didn't know that those existed, those clearly have existed for a very long time. And so it's important to understand that, you know, the government has been actively trying to control people's minds for a very long time. So here you go. We're going to talk a little bit about the USSR and the switching between how easy it is to switch labels between who is good country and who is bad country. William Donovan, head of America's wartime intelligence service, once said famously, "I'd put Stalin on the payroll if I thought it would help us defeat Hitler." In an all too easy reversal, it was now apparent that Germans, again, this is right after World War II, Germans were to be our new friends and the savior Russians, the enemy. This, to Arthur Miller, was an ignoble thing. It seemed to me in later years that this wrenching shift, this ripping off of good and evil labels from one nation and pasting them onto another, had done something to wither the very notion of a world even theoretically moral. If last month's friend could so quickly become this month's enemy, what depth of reality could good and evil have? The nihilism, even worse, the yawning amusement toward the very concept of a moral imperative, which would become a hallmark of international culture, was born in these 8 to 10 years of realignment after Hitler's death. And that's something we see now. I mean, we'll get into a little bit of how the Central Intelligence Agency was manipulating Hollywood at that time to support their movement of labels from, Germany bad at one day, then the next year, Russia is now bad, even though Russia last year was a good guy. It's very Orwellian, you know, or Orwell does. You can even see it today, and certainly in the War on Terror, where they just shift names of the bad guy. becomes Al-Qaeda. You know, it's Al-Nusra, it's Muslim Brotherhood, it's ISIS, it's ISIL. You know, it's just shifting names and to you know, keep the enemy fresh, keep the enemy alive in the minds of the population. With an energy and resourcefulness which showed that Stalin's regime, for all its monolithic intractability, could avail itself of an imaginative vigor unmatched by Western governments, the Soviet Union deployed a battery of unconventional weapons to nudge itself into the European consciousness and soften up opinion in its favor. Again, so the Soviets were already very well studied in the art of psychological warfare and manipulation of people's mind. A vast network of fronts was established, some new, some revived from a dormant state since the death in 1940 of Willy Munzberg, the brain behind the Kremlin's secret pre-war campaign of persuasion. Labor unions, women's movements, youth groups, cultural institutions, the press, publishing, all were targeted. Experts in the use of culture as a tool of political persuasion, the Soviets did much in these early years of the Cold War to establish a central paradigm as a cultural one. Lacking the economic power of the United States and, above all, still without a nuclear capability, Stalin's regime concentrated on winning the battle for men's minds. America, despite a massive marshaling of the arts in the New Deal period, was a virgin in the practice of international Kulturkampf. As early as 1945, one intelligence officer had predicted the unconventional tactics which were now being adopted by the Soviets. The invention of the atomic bomb will cause a shift in the balance of between peaceful and warlike methods of exerting international pressure, he reported to the chief of the Office of Strategic Services, that's the OSS, the precursor to the CIA, General Donovan. And we must expect a very marked increase in the importance of peaceful methods, so-called. Our enemies will be even freer than ever to propagandize, subvert, sabotage, and exert pressures upon us, and we ourselves shall be more willing to bear these affronts and ourselves to indulge in such methods, in our eagerness to avoid at all costs the tragedy of open war. Peaceful techniques will become more vital in times of pre-war softening up, actual overt war, and in times of post-war manipulation. So basically, at all times, it's going to be part of manipulation. This report shows exceptional prescience. It offers a definition of the Cold War as a psychological contest of the manufacturing of consent by peaceful methods, of the use of propaganda to erode hostile positions. And as the opening sallies in Berlin amply demonstrated, the operational weapon was to be culture. The cultural Cold War was on. So it was that amidst the degradation, an unnaturally elaborate cultural life was dragged to its feet by the occupying powers as they vied with each other to score propaganda points. So you see the America was this, you know, had a nice plan, and we'll get into that obviously, of establishing a cultural organization in Europe after World War II, where their purpose was to directly combat the propaganda coming from the Soviet Union. But again, this is not overt propaganda. They weren't going to tell everyone, hey, we're actually funded by the Central Intelligence Agency, you know? And so it's a secretive way of manipulating the mind of populations. But without, you know, too much longer here, we're going to talk about Rumors Sports Bar and Casino, our second sponsor. Rumors is home of the famous Beer Tower, and they have a great atmosphere and wall-to-wall TVs for those of you who, you know, are into that. It's especially, you know, great for bingo and charitable gaming. And of course, the Kentucky Derby is coming this May, and you can certainly enjoy that at Rumors. They have wonderful drink deals and food specials. So please go check out Rumor Sports Bar and Casino here in the Grand Cities Mall. All right, back to the CIA and the Cultural Cold War. This next character, perhaps some of you have heard of, was nicknamed the father of the Cold War in Berlin. And it is a man named Melvin Lasky. And Melvin Lasky, he wrote the Melvin Lasky Proposal in 1947, and he had high hopes for peace and international unity that blinded us to the fact that a concerted political war against the USA was being prepared and executed, and nowhere more vigorously than German. Of course, he's in Germany. He's referring to the USSR's use of psychological warfare to, you know, bring more people over to the side of the USSR. In extraordinary language, Lasky went on to define the challenge, the time-honored U.S. formula of shed light and the people will find their own way, exaggerates the possibilities in Germany and in Europe for an easy conversion. Again, so he's saying just telling them the truth isn't good enough. It would be foolish to expect to wean a primitive savage away from his conviction in mysterious jungle herbs simply by the dissemination of modern scientific medical information. We have not succeeded in combating the variety of factors, political, psychological, cultural, which work against U.S. foreign policy and in particular against the success of the Marshall Plan in Europe. What was needed now, continued Lasky breathlessly, was an active truth, a truth bold enough to enter the contest, not one which behaved like an Olympic bystander. Make no mistake, he warned, the substance of the Cold War was cultural in range, and it is here that a serious void in the American program has been most exploited by the enemies of American foreign policy. The void is real and grave. The real and grave void to which Lasky referred was the failure to win the educated and cultural classes, which, in the long run, provide moral and political leadership in the community to the American cause. This shortcoming, he argued, could be partly addressed by publishing a new journal, one which would serve both as a constructive fillip to German-European thought and also as a demonstration that behind the official representatives of American democracy lies a great and progressive culture with a richness of achievement in the arts, in literature, in philosophy, and all the aspects of culture which unite the free traditions of Europe and America. 2 days later, Lasky submitted a prospectus for the American Review, whose purpose should be to support the general objectives of U.S. policy in Germany and Europe by illustrating the background of ideas, spiritual activity, literary and intellectual achievement from which the American democracy takes its inspiration. So he's proposing to the American government, hey, I want to be part of this Congress for Cultural Freedom, and to put out a magazine that no one who's reading this, in fact, most people who work at the magazine aren't going to know that it's being funded by the American government dollars. The result was Der Monat, a monthly magazine designed to construct an ideological bridge between German and American intellectuals, and as explicitly set forth by Lasky, to ease the passage of American foreign policy interests by supporting the general objectives of U.S. policy in Germany and Europe. Across the years, Der Monat was financed through confidential funds of the Marshall Plan, then from the coffers of the Central Intelligence Agency, then with foreign foundation money, and we talked about that probably last week a little bit as well, but certainly the week before, and then again with CIA dollars. For its financing alone, the magazine was absolutely a product and an exemplar of American Cold War strategies in the cultural field. Der Monat was a temple to the belief that an educated elite could steer the post-war world away from its own extinction. This, together with their affiliations to the American occupation government, was what united Lasky, Josselson, and Nabokov, like Jean Cocteau, who was soon to warn America, you will not be saved by weaponry, nor by money, but by a thinking minority, because the world is expiring as it does not think anymore, but merely spends. He's absolutely right about that, and he's certainly more true today. They understood that the dollars of the Marshall Plan, and the Marshall Plan was it was enacted right after, I think it was 1948, by U.S. Congress, and it was a system of financial support to the Western European governments after World War II. They understood that the dollars of the Marshall Plan would not be enough. Financial assistance had to be supplemented by a concentrated program of cultural warfare. This curious triumvirate, Lasky, the political militant, Josselson, the former department store buyer, and Nabokov, the composer, now stood poised at the cutting edge of what was to become, under their guidance, one of the most ambitious secret operations of the Cold War, the winning over of the Western intelligentsia to the American proposition. Now here we're going to get into some of the Central Intelligence Agency boys who were behind this. Created by the National Security Act of 26 July 1947, the agency was originally intended to coordinate military and diplomatic intelligence. Crucially, and in extremely vague language, it was also authorized to carry out unspecified services of common concern, and such other functions and duties as the National Security Council, created under the same act, might direct. Nowhere in the 1947 Act was the CIA explicitly empowered to collect intelligence or intervene secretly in the affairs of other nations, a government report later stated. But the elastic phrase, such other functions, was used by successive presidents to move the agency into espionage, covert action, paramilitary operations, and technical intelligence collection. And we're going to get into a lot of books about the CIA. Don't worry about that. The founding of the CIA marked a dramatic overhaul of the traditional paradigms of American politics. The terms under which the agency was established institutionalized the concepts of the necessary lie and plausible deniability as legitimate peacetime strategies, and in the long run, produced an invisible layer of government. Have you heard invisible government before? Whose potential for abuse domestically and abroad was uninhibited by any sense of accountability. This experience of limitless influence was exemplified by the eponymous hero of Norman Mailer's monumental Harlot's Ghost. "We tap into everything," says Harlot. "If good crops are an instrument of foreign policy, then we are obliged to know next year's weather. The same demand comes at us everywhere we look. Finance, media, labor relations, economic production, the thematic consequences of television. Where is the end to all that we can be legitimately interested in? Nobody knows how many pipelines we have in good places, how many Pentagon poobahs, commodores, congressmen, professors in assorted think tanks, soil erosion specialists, student leaders, diplomats, corporate lawyers, name it, they all give us input. Owning airlines, radio stations, newspapers, insurance companies, and real estate, the CIA's presence in world affairs grew so prodigiously over the decades that people began to suspect its presence behind every thicket. The CIA took its character from its wartime predecessor, the Office of Strategic Services, set up in 1941 in the wake of Pearl Harbor and disbanded in September 1945. OSSers found themselves roving wartime Europe like latter-day proconsuls. The first OSS man to reach Bucharest after the German withdrawal in autumn 1944 became a regular guest at meetings of the Romanian cabinet and boasted to colleagues, "Before they vote on anything, they ask me what I think. They pass all my laws unanimously. I never thought running a country was so easy." Think about that. But what running a country was precisely what most OSSers were brought up to do. Recruiting from the heart of America's corporate, political, academic, and cultural establishment, an elite corps which hailed from America's most powerful institutions and families. Members of the Mellon family held espionage posts in Madrid, London, Geneva, Paris. Paul Mellon worked for the Special Operations Executive in London. His sister, Elisa, known as the world's richest woman, was married to his commanding officer, Chief of OSS London, David Bruce, son of U.S. Senator and millionaire in his own right. J.P. Morgan's sons were both in the OSS. The families Vanderbilt, DuPont, Archbold, Ryan, Equal Life Insurance, Weil, Macy's Department Store, Whitney's also Skull and Bones. Recall from last week what the Skull and Bones is. We're all represented in the ranks of Donovan's secret army. And also, they also had Julia McWilliams Child. Remember Julia Child? Later, a celebrity chef who maintained OSS intelligence files in Chongqing. So they even had, you know, Julia Child, this famous television chef, probably like the first, she's like the archetype of the television chef. She was an OSS, the precursor to the CIA. She was an intelligence officer. What does that say about Julia Child? You know, like if you were, I mean, you'd have to be of an older generation to have watched regularly her. But what if you were? Like, does that, you know, taint your understanding of what the purpose of Julia Child was? It was this historic elite, the Ivy Leaguers, who cast their influence on America's boardrooms, academic institutions, major newspapers and media, law firms and government, who now stepped forward to fill the ranks of the fledgling agency. It says even, who's this guy right here? Avril Harriman, Skull and Bones. He was the big time Skull and Bones man who was, you know, propping up the USSR as well as the Nazis before World War II with his vast amount of wealth. So the Skull and Bones is all over this as well. These guys were patricians of the modern age, the paladins of democracy, and saw no contradiction in that. This was the elite which ran American foreign policy and shaped legislation at home. Through think tanks to foundations, directorates to membership of gentlemen's clubs, these mandarins were interlocked by their institutional affiliations and by a shared belief in their own superiority. There's certainly a superiority complex amongst these gentlemen. And we're going to talk here again about some more of this, the documents that came out of the CIA. And we're going to talk about this guy named George Kennan here, who was a big timer in the early CIA. On 19 December 1947, Kennan's political philosophy acquired legal authority in a directive issued by Truman, President Truman's National Security Council, NSC 4. A top secret appendix to this directive, NSC 4A, instructed the director of the Central Intelligence to undertake a covert psychological activities in support of American anti-communist policies. Startlingly opaque about what procedures should be followed for coordination or approving such activities, this appendix was the first formal post-war authorization for clandestine operations, superseded in June 1948 by a new and more explicit directive drafted by George Kennan, NSC 10-2. These were the documents which piloted American intelligence into the choppy waters of secret political warfare for decades to come. Prepared in the tightest secrecy, these directives adopted an expansive conception of America's security requirements to include a world substantially made over in its own image. It's an important line there. Proceeding from the premise that the Soviet Union and its satellite countries were embarked on a program of vicious covert activities to discredit and defeat the aims and activities of the United States and other Western powers. NSC 10-2 gave the highest sanction of the government to a plethora of covert operations, propaganda, economic warfare, preventative direct action, including sabotage, anti-sabotage, demolition and evacuation measures, subversion against hostile states, including assistance to underground resistance movements, guerrillas and refugee liberation groups. All such activities, in the words of NSC 10-2, must be so planned and executed that any U.S. government responsibility for them is not evident to unauthorized persons, and that if uncovered, the U.S. government can plausibly disclaim any responsibility for them. NSC 10-2 established a special staff for covert operations within the CIA, but with policy and personnel under the policy planning staff of the State Department, in other words, under Kennan's control. This staff was eventually called the Office of Policy Coordination, an innocuous title designed to ensure plausibility while revealing practically nothing of its own purpose. Covert action was defined as any clandestine activity designed to influence foreign governments, events, organizations, or persons in support of U.S. foreign policy conducted in such a way that the involvement of the U.S. government is not apparent. Virtually unlimited in scope and secrecy, OPC was without precedent in peacetime America. Here was the dirty tricks department that Alan Dulles, the CIA guy, and the Park Avenue Cowboys had been campaigning for. So now they had legal, not lawful. Those are two different things. Legal right to do basically whatever they wanted to fulfill their ends of, in this case, cultural warfare. And specifically what we're talking about this book is cultural warfare. But you can see that they used this NSC 10-2 to as the auspices under which they could do all kinds of government subversion of whatever government they didn't like. Okay, so again, that's why this is legal, but it's very much not lawful. Okay, so then again, this the bureaucracy of these intelligence agencies we'll see goes even deeper. And then there's what was called the International Organizations Division. International Organizations Division. The formation of this new division, abbreviated IOD, coincided with and its activities were sanctioned by a new National Security Directive, NSC-68. NSC-68 became the supreme documentary symbol of the Cold War and was based on the assumption of a communist monolith whose guiding spirit resided in the Kremlin. The directive concluded that practical and ideological considerations both impel us to the conclusion that we have no choice but to demonstrate the superiority of the idea of freedom by its constructive application. Truth also needs propaganda. Let's just say truth also needs propaganda. I disagree vehemently with this. I think if you have truth on your side and you go out in public and you debate, you look for debate, you engage on ideas and evidence-based ideas, you don't need to propagandize people. Instead of propagandizing people, they should have been debating. They should have had open, honest discussions, and they should be doing this today on any number of topics. Pick a topic, that's what should be happening. In a civilized society, in an intellectual society, that's what would be happening. We don't need these covert means to manipulate people's minds. And Francis Stoner Saunders referred to that earlier on. So again, they said these guys believe that the truth also needs propaganda. The philosopher Carl Jaspers had recently declared, "Here was the mandate which authorized America's cold warriors to take constructive measures to ensure that the truth triumphed over deceit." The budgetary provisions set out by NSC 68 revealed the importance now given to this task. In the next 2 years, the $34 million spent on psychological warfare in 1950 was to be quadrupled. That's a stunning amount of money, even today. But that's, I mean, an unbelievably large amount of money for this time. In the contest for men's minds, truth can be peculiarly the American weapon, Secretary of State Edward Barnett announced. It cannot be an isolated weapon because the propaganda of truth is powerful only when linked with concrete actions and policies. A highly skillful and substantial campaign of truth is as indispensable as an air force. The truth, like the century, was to belong to America. If deceit was needed to be used to promote truth, then so be it. It was what Kessler called fighting against a total lie in the name of a half-truth. Again, I disagree with that concept. The purpose of the International Operations Division, said Braden, was to unite, and Braden was a CIA, a big CIA guy at this time too, I can't remember if he's the director or not, was to unite intellectuals against what was being offered in the Soviet Union. The idea that the world would succumb to a kind of fascist or Stalinist concept of art and literature and music was a horrifying prospect. We wanted to unite all the people who were artists, who were writers, who were musicians, and all the people who follow those people to demonstrate that the West and the United States was devoted to freedom of expression and to intellectual achievement without any rigid barriers as to what you must write and what you must say and what you must do and what you must paint, which was what was going on in the Soviet Union. I think we did it damn well. I mean, again, this is just hypocritical, right? It was to encourage, the IOD again, was to encourage the intelligentsia to develop theories and arguments which were directed not at mass audience, but at that small elite of pressure groups and statesmen who in turn determined government policy. It was to provide independent support for American foreign policy objectives, which sought to promote a united Europe through membership of NATO, which is a totally evil organization, and the European movement, the latter being substantially endowed by the CIA, which included a reunified Germany. It was to act as an emissary for the achievements of American culture and to work to undermine the negative stereotypes prevalent in Europe, especially France, about America's perceived cultural barrenness. So again, you see there's a lot of, money flowing from the Central Intelligence Agency into Europe, into these organizations to, you know, control people's likes and dislikes of music, of art, of literature, of magazines. That is the antithesis. That's why I call this hypocritical. That is the antithesis of, you know, what freedom truly stands for. However, we will continue after this short ad from our friends at Oh for Heaven's Cakes here in the Grand Cities Mall. There's nothing better than treating to yourself to some good homemade baked goods. That's where Oh for Heaven's Cakes comes in. The best cupcakes and cakes for special occasions or just a treat. They do make incredible specialty items by order or just walk in to find out more. While you're there, enjoy homemade lunch and soup with keto, gluten-free, vegan, and diabetic options. And if you're a business owner and want to treat your employees, check out their monthly employee discounts. Oh, for Heaven's Cakes on the north backside of the Grand Cities Mall, open Tuesday through Friday from 10 to 4 and Saturdays 9 o'clock to noon. Call 701-757-CAKE. That's 701-757-2253 or go to ohforheavenscakes@yahoo.com. Be a beautiful cupcake in a world full of muffins. Oh, for Heaven's Cakes in the Grand Cities Mall. Order your graduation cakes early. And I'll personally vouch for Oh, for Heaven's Cakes. It's a wonderful, wonderful, delicious bakery for sure. So from some fun cakes to some more disturbing information. So again, we continue here. This they built a consortium of organizations now, Homesite as well, to again control culture and to funnel money into the control of what people think is good art. Cultural freedom, quote unquote, she put quotes, did not come cheap. Over the next 17 years, the CIA was to pump tens of millions of dollars into the Congress for Cultural Freedom and related projects. With this kind of commitment, the CIA was in effect acting as America's Ministry of Culture. America's Ministry of Culture. And we're going to see shortly that they were also doing it on the home front, and obviously still are today. A central feature of the agency's efforts to mobilize culture as a Cold War weapon was the systematic organization of a network of private groups or friends into an unofficial consortium. This was an entrepreneurial coalition of philanthropic foundations, business corporations, and other institutions and individuals who worked hand in hand with the CIA to provide the cover and the funding pipeline for its secret programs in Western Europe. Additionally, these friends could be depended on to articulate the government's interests at home and abroad whilst appearing to do so solely on their own initiative. Maintaining their private status, these individuals and bodies were in fact acting as the CIA's designated Cold War venture capitalists. It means they're pumping lots of money into it. The inspiration behind this consortium was Alan Dulles, and we'll get into Alan Dulles specifically in books to come. Alan Dulles, who had started to build its foundations after the war, when he and his brother John Foster Dulles were partners at the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell. In May 1949, Alan Dulles presided over the formation of the National Committee for a Free Europe, ostensibly the initiative of a group of private American citizens, but in reality, one of the CIA's most ambitious fronts. Incorporated on 11 May 1949 in New York, the declared purpose of the National Committee for a Free Europe, again, you can see this bureaucracy, they keep pumping millions and millions of dollars through this layer for this thing, and it's just all, it's hard to pinpoint it at one thing, you know, especially if you're on the outside trying to find out what's going on here. You're going to have one heck of a time figuring this stuff out. I mean, it took, you know, 50 years. Again, this book was published in 1999, so it took a long time. And I don't know what, you can actually find Frances Stoner Saunders on YouTube. I check it out. She's alive and well today. She gives wonderful lectures about this material, and I don't remember what her initial inspiration was for finding this stuff, but it starts with an intuition, there's this piece of information where the CIA was, you know, manipulating culture of Europe in 1950s, you know, and then she dug and this is what came out of it. So just the layers and layers and layers of bureaucracy and money that's flowing into from all these different sources is absolutely incredible. Incorporated on 11 May 1949 in New York, the declared purpose of the National Committee for a Free Europe Incorporated was to use the many and varied skills of exiled East Europeans in the development of programs which will actively combat Soviet domination. Committed to the belief that this struggle can be resolved as much by force of ideas as by physical means, the committee was soon to extend its reach into all areas of the Cultural Cold War. The State Department is very happy to see the formation of this group, announced Secretary of State Dean Acheson. Dean Acheson, Skull and Bones. Dean Acheson, Skull and Bones. Again, that's how you can remember, like, just think about how evil this stuff is now. Always have that thought in your mind, that perspective. And again, also, I forgot to mention this so far, but please buy this book, read this book, read it for yourselves, because again, maybe I'm interpreting this stuff wrong. As always, I like to keep an open mind and I want to present truth. That's my only interest here, is to present the truth. But Dean Acheson, the truth about Dean Acheson is he was Secretary of State at this time, praising the formation of these, you know, occult committees to control culture unbeknownst to everyone, and he's Skull and Bones. That is the truth. It thinks, again, he continues, Secretary of State Dean Acheson, it thinks that the purpose of this organization is excellent and is glad to welcome its entrance into this field and give it its hearty endorsement. This public blessing was intended to mask the official origins of the committee and the fact that it operated solely at the discretion of the CIA, which provided 90% financial support through unvouchered funds. Behind Acheson's endorsement was another concealed truth. Although the committee's founding statute included the clause, "No part of the activities of the corporation shall be carrying on of propaganda," this was precisely and specifically what it was designed to do. Moving to the CIA in December 1950, Allen Dulles became the Great White Case Officer of the National Committee for a Free Europe. Dulles understood that the success of America's Cold War program depended on its ability to appear independent from government, to seem to represent the spontaneous convictions of freedom-loving individuals. Again, it's a lie, right? Spontaneous. There's nothing spontaneous about what they're doing here to people. For this aspect alone, the National Committee for a Free Europe Incorporated serves as a paradigm for the CIA-led corporatization of the foreign policy machinery in the Cold War period. The National Committee for a Free Europe boasted a membership which reads like a who's who in America. Let's get into some information. You know, it's so interesting because a lot of these books that we're going to get into now, I haven't read. I've heard about, I've heard lectures on, like that type of thing. And I have hundreds of books on my book list, so there will be no shortage of these books. But it's so awesome how they're starting to jive together. You know, once you pick pieces of, you know, about foundations or about the Skull and Bones and now about the CIA and the Cultural Cold War, and these themes blend together to paint an accurate picture of the truth of what's going on here. And again, we're going to get into these big foundations. Remember the Ford Foundations, Carnegie Foundations, Rockefeller Foundations, et cetera, that we mentioned a few episodes ago. Were pushing to change education. They were pushing new sex ideas onto our society, you know, to change the mores of our culture. And these guys, as you're about, we're going to read here, pumped great amounts of money into changing the art and literature, et cetera, of Europe. And again, two episodes ago, we documented very well how they were doing it here at home. The fundraising arm of the Free Europe Committee was the Crusade for Freedom, for which a young actor named Ronald Reagan was leading spokesman and publicist. The Crusade for Freedom was used to launder money to support a program run by Bill Casey, the future CIA director, called the International Refuge Committee in New York, which allegedly coordinated the exfiltration of Nazis from Germany to the States, where they were expected to assist the government in its struggle against communism. So Ronald Reagan was the front man, the actor, for this thing that was exfiltrating Nazis. What does that tell you about Ronald Reagan, ladies and gentlemen? Let's you know, we're going to get into more history of these guys, too, and some... definitely a lot darker information than even what I just read there. We generally reached out to find Americans who would consent to take the money into their accounts and then use it to contribute in various ways, said covert action agent William Colby. If you went to any American institution, company, anything else, and said, hey, will you help your country by passing this money? They'd salute and say, absolutely, I'd be delighted. It's easy to pass money around the world to the desired end objective. It might not be one bulk payment, but various small payments going in the right direction. This goes all the way to the rather more naked thing that I was sometimes engaged in, which is putting bundles of local currency in the back of my car and driving out and transferring them to another fellow's car. The American companies and individuals who agreed to collaborate with the agency in this way were known as quiet channels. These channels could also be established after contact was made the other way around. Oftentimes, private American groups came to us. Remember Case Officer Lee Williams? We didn't just always go to them. There was a commonality of purpose that seemed to us to dissolve any major concerns about the morality of what we were doing. The use of philanthropic foundations, again, that's the Ford, Carnegie, Rockefeller, blah, 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 was the most convenient way to pass large sums of money to agency projects without alerting the recipients to their source. And there's a lot of CIA guys on the board of trustees of these things. And again, Skull and Bones is almost always in the background there. By the mid-1950s, the CIA's intrusion into the foundation field was massive. Although figures are not available for this period, the General Counsel of a 1952 Congress committee appointed to investigate, that's what we talked about 2 weeks ago, to investigate U.S. foundations concluded that an unparalleled amount of power is concentrated increasingly in the hands of an interlocking and self-perpetuating group. I think I actually read this exactly from that book. Unlike the power of corporate management, it is unchecked by stockholders. Unlike the power of government, it is unchecked by the people. Unlike the power of churches, it is unchecked by a firmly established canons of value. In 1976, a select committee appointed to investigate U.S. intelligence activities reported on the CIA's penetration of foundation field by the mid-1960s. During 1963 to 66, of the 700 grants over $10,000 given by 164 foundations, at least 108 involved partial or complete CIA funding. More importantly, CIA funding was involved in nearly half the grants made by these 164 foundations in the field of international activities during the same period. Bona fide foundations such as Ford, Rockefeller, and Carnegie were considered the best and most plausible kind of funding cover. And again, we documented what kind of funding they were giving out a couple weeks ago. So if you haven't seen that episode, go check it out. A CIA study of 1966 argued that this technique was particularly effective for democratically run membership organizations, which need to assure their own unwitting members and collaborators, as well as their hostile critics, that they have genuine, respectable private sources of income. Nothing clandestine, nothing dark here. Certainly allowed the CIA to fund a seemingly limitless range of covert action programs affecting youth groups, labor unions, universities, publishing houses, and other private institutions from the early 1950s. There was a cover branch at CIA whose job it was to help provide cover like the foundations we use for our operations, Braden explained. I paid no attention to the details. I don't know the names of all of them. I can't remember, but it was a crisscross of money. There was never any danger of the CIA running out of money. The crisscross of money filtered its way through a raft of host foundations, some acting as fronts, some as conduits. Known to have wittingly facilitated CIA funding, passes were over 170 foundations. The bureaucracy gets even bigger. Later, the joke was that if any American philanthropic or cultural organization carried the words free or private in its literature, it must be a CIA front. This was the consortium at work, calling in favors across the old school tie network, the OSS network, the boardrooms of America, massive bureaucracy funding money to control minds across the globe. They goes on to detail that the CIA had control of a number of printing presses to control what books are coming out. You know, we already talked about Der Monat, that magazine. They had 20 different magazines that they were secretly funding to push American propaganda in the West. All right. I'm going to get into psychological strategy boards. Psychological strategy boards. Despite State Department resistance, George Kennan championed the idea and was instrumental in persuading President Truman to sign a secret directive establishing the Psychological Strategy Board on 4 April 1951. It was this board, its Orwellian title was soon reduced to its initials PSB, which was now instructed to draw up the policy blueprint that C.D. Jackson had called for. The Psychological Strategy Board's doctrinal or ideological plan was first proposed in a paper called PSB D-33/2. The paper itself is still classified, but in a lengthy internal memo, a worried PSB officer, Charles Burton Marshall, quoted freely from the passages which most exercised him. How can a government interpose with a wide doctrinal system of its own without taking on the color of totalitarianism, he asked. The paper does not indicate any. Indeed, it accepts uniformity as a substitute for diversity. It postulates a system justifying a particular type of social belief and structure, providing a body of principles for human aspirations and embracing all fields of human thought. All fields of intellectual interests, from anthropology and artistic creations to sociology and scientific methodology. Marshall, who was to become a staunch opponent of PSB, went on to criticize the paper's call for a machinery to produce ideas portraying the American way of life on a systematic and scientific basis. I'll read that again. The paper by the PSB calls for a machinery to produce ideas portraying the American way of life on a systematic and scientific basis. Again, they want you to come to conclusions that you think are your own, but are not. And this is something that's been in the works for 70 years. It's been going on for 70. It's not in the works. It's been going on for 70 years. So, I mean, these, in my opinion, these organizations have outstayed their welcome by a million miles. They need to go bye-bye. One of the controversial things that JFK said before he was assassinated was that he was going to shatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter it into the wind. Do you think the Central Intelligence Agency abided that? No. It anticipates, again, the systematic and scientific basis producing doctrinal production under a coordination mechanism. It asserts a premium on swift and positive action to galvanize the creation and distribution of ideas. Not your own ideas, their own, their ideas, not yours. It foretells a long-term intellectual movement as growing out of this effort and having the aim not only to counter communism, but indeed to break down worldwide doctrinaire thought patterns, providing an intellectual basis for doctrines hostile to American objectives. His conclusion was adamant. This is just about as totalitarian as one can get. Marshall also took issue with the PSB's reliance on non-rational social theories, which emphasized the role of an elite in a manner reminiscent of Pareto, Sorel, Mussolini, and so on. Individuals are relegated to a tertiary importance, Marshall continued. The supposed elite emerges as the only group that counts. The elite is defined as that numerically limited group capable and interested in manipulating doctrinal matters, the men of ideas who pull the intellectual strings in forming, or at least predisposing, the attitudes and opinions of those who in turn lead public opinion. According to Marshall's exegesis, the PSB planned to work on the elite in each area, all areas, so as to predispose its members to the philosophy held by the planners. Use of local elites would help conceal the American origin of the effort so that it appears to be a native development. But it wasn't just aimed at foreigners. Though the paper disavowed any intention of propagandizing Americans, it did commit itself to a program of indoctrination in the military services by injecting the right ideas into servicemen's comic books and having their chaplains propagate them. That's something that men of cloth shouldn't be tossing around American government propaganda. That's totally unacceptable. As you'll see, this was certainly not limited just to military men. As far as the attitudes that the agency wanted to inspire through these activities are concerned, clearly what they would like to have been able to produce were people who, of their own reason and conviction, were persuaded that everything the United States government did was right. Everything the United States government does is right, always, no matter what. And if you question that, you're an American and you should be tossed in the ocean, never thought of again. And in May 1952, the newly strengthened PSB formally took over supervision of the pace and timing of the CIA's psychological warfare program, codenamed Packet. By June 1953, Packet was just one of the PSB's doctrinal program, whose psychological objectives were defined in a new paper as appealing to intellectuals, scholars, and opinion-forming groups in order to break down worldwide doctrinaire thought patterns which have provided an intellectual basis for communism and other doctrines hostile to American and free world objectives. So we're talking global objectives here. Less than 2 years after its creation, the PSB had finally succeeded in establishing itself as an integral part of the development and implementation of foreign policy, enjoying unrivaled access to the secret machinations of the PSB and the government departments it embraced. C.D. Jackson became the most sought-after figure in that tight circle of power, which became known as the invisible government. The invisible government, indeed, still alive and stronger than ever today. So now we're going to talk about art, and in particular, what they branded as the American, the truly American style of art. Now, I'm not really a connoisseur of art. I do like some. I have some. I hope to buy some more in the future. And I revile this type of art I'll just put it out there. I'll be totally open with you. This type of art is called abstract expressionism. If you're not familiar with it, Google it. And some of the artists that we're about to name here, please Google them and look at their work, and that is abstract Expressionism. Where Dondero saw an abstract Dondero was a senator or congressman who was totally against this abstract expressionism. Where Dondero saw an abstract expressionism, evidence of a communist conspiracy, America's cultural mandarins detected a contrary virtue. For them, it spoke to a specifically anti-communist ideology, the ideology of freedom, of free enterprise. Non-figurative and politically silent, it was the very antithesis to socialist realism. It was precisely the kind of art the Soviets loved to hate. But it was more than this. It was claimed as apologists, an explicitly American intervention in the modernist canon. As early as 1946, critics were applauding the new art as independent, self-reliant, a true expression of the national will, spirit, and character. It seems that, in aesthetic character, U.S. art is no longer a repository of European influences, that it is not a mere amalgamate of foreign isms, assembled, compiled, and assimilated with lesser or greater intelligence. Elevated as a chief representative of this new national discovery was Jackson Pollock. Jackson Pollock, check him out. He was the great American painter, and I reject this totally. I guess we're going to talk about what this... They describe this style here. Yeah, here we go. Jackson Pollock came up with a technique known as action painting, which involved laying a huge canvas flat on the ground, preferably outdoors, and dripping paint all over it. In the splurgy, random knots of lines which threaded their way across the canvas and over the edges, he seemed to be engaged in the act of rediscovering America. And that kind of makes me want to vomit in my mouth. You know, that's something I can do. That's something you can do. And believe me, if you saw some of my drawings, you would think I was challenged. I'll just put it that way. And this is just some dude splashing art, you know, just paint randomly on stuff. And then people are like, oh, that's such a wonderful art. No, it's not. It's not even art. It's grotesque, in my opinion. But this is what the CIA was pushing. They were thrusting it upon the West, and you'll see they were thrusting it upon our Western Europe, and they were also thrusting it upon the United States, and we're about to get there. By 1948, the art critic Clement Greenberg, himself a brawling, boozing one-man slugfest, was making prodigal claims for the new aesthetic. When one sees how much the level of American art has risen in the last 5 years, with the emergence of new talents so full of energy and content as, again, Google these guys, Arshil Gorky, Jackson Pollock, David Smith, then the conclusion forces itself. Much to our own surprise, the main premises of Western art have at least migrated to the United States, along with the center of gravity of industrial production and political power. America, in other words, was the place an artist no longer felt he had to escape from in order to mature in Europe. Commenting on this claim, rather than agreeing with it, Jason Epstein later said America, and especially New York, had now become the center of the world politically and financially, and of course, it had become the center culturally as well. And you know, there's actually a really good movie. I think it was 2013-ish, I want to say. It won, and it's probably the best movie I've seen since I watched it around 2013, but it still, you know, resonates with me. It's the best movie I've seen since then. It actually won the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film, so it is all in Italian, but it's called The Great Beauty or La Grande Bellezza or something like that in Italian. And it has maybe the most powerful scene I've seen in all of cinema, actually, at least to me. And it shows the dichotomy, the difference between this modern crappy art and the old art. It's a wonderful scene and a very good movie, so check it out. But we continue. Eager to show the world that here was an art commensurate with America's greatness and freedom, again, it makes me want to puke, high-level strategists found they couldn't publicly support it because of domestic opposition. Again, so this is something that the people did not want, absolutely did not want, yet it was forced upon them in an effort to shift our culture. So what did they do? They turned to the CIA. A struggle began to assert the merits of abstract expressionism against attempts to smear it. That's one of the reasons why it had to be done covertly. It had to be covert because it would have been turned down if it had been put to a vote in a democracy. In order to encourage openness, we had to be secret. I mean, this revolting. Here again was the sublime paradox of American strategy in the cultural Cold War. In order to promote an acceptance of art produced in and vaunted as the expression of democracy, the democratic process itself had to be circumvented. Once again, the CIA turned to the private sector to advance its objectives. In America, most museums and collections of art were, as they are now, privately owned and privately funded. Preeminent amongst contemporary and avant-garde art museums was the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Its president, through most of the 1940s and 1950s, was Nelson Rockefeller, whose mother, Abby Aldrich Rockefeller, had co-founded the museum in 1929. Nelson called it Mommy's Museum. Nelson was a keen supporter of abstract expressionism, which he referred to as free enterprise painting. So again, harking back to a few sections ago when I read that this secret document that man was exposing says that they needed an elite that had monetary and intellectual influence over the population to exert its influence. And that's what's happening here. Supporting left-wing artists was familiar territory for the Rockefellers. The avant-garde, wrote Greenberg, had been abandoned by those to whom it actually belongs, our ruling class. In Europe, traditionally support was provided by an elite among the ruling class, from which the avant-garde assumed itself to be cut off, but to which it had always remained attached by an umbilical cord of gold. In the United States, he argued, the same mechanism must prevail. The deep connection between abstract expressionism and the cultural Cold War can be found here. It was according to this principle that the CIA, together with its private venture capitalists, operated. Patronage, in Braden's terms, carried with it a duty to instruct, to educate people to accept not what they want or think they want, but what they ought to have. You have always to battle your own ignoramuses, or to put it more politely, people who just don't understand. Because you don't understand. You don't understand that abstract expressionism is garbage. You can't have that opinion, and if you have that opinion, you're not an intellectual. And the CIA is going to tell you what's what. That's what's going on here. And they're going to use big time money to do it. There is a perverse way of looking at this question, which is to say the CIA took art very seriously, commented art critic Philip Dodd. The great thing about politicians when they get involved in art is it means something to them, whether it's the fascists or the Soviets or the American CIA. So there may be a really perverse argument that says the CIA were the best art critics, I disagree totally with that, in America in the 50s because they saw work that actually should have been antipathetic to them, made by old lefties coming out of European surrealism, and they saw the potential power in that kind of art and ran with it. You couldn't say that of many art critics at the time. Well, maybe those other art critics just hated abstract expressionism, which is certainly a valid opinion. So here we go. Here's some more of the money powers behind this stuff. William Paley, heir to the Congress Cigar Company, was yet another Museum of Modern Art trustee with close links to the intelligence world. A personal friend of Alan Dulles, Paley allowed CBS, that CBS, the network he owned, to provide cover for CIA employees in an arrangement similar to that authorized by Henry Lucy at his Time Life Empire. And Henry Lucy, I don't know if that's, maybe it's Lucy, I don't know, is Skull and Bones. Skull and Bones, the guy who runs Time Magazine, Time and Life Magazines, Skull and Bones. Lucy was also a Museum of Modern Art trustee. At the height of this relationship, the CBS correspondents joined the CIA hierarchy once a year for private dinners and briefings. So again, already way back then, CBS is taking some for sure. We don't know how much of their talking points directly from the Central Intelligence Agency. There's Operation Mockingbird, which is alive and well today, which is they get Central Intelligence Agency assets to be news anchors. Check it out. Go look for yourself. These dinners, grown-up affairs with good table talk and good cigars, were held at Dulles' home or at his private club, the Alibi, in Washington. Of Paley's involvement with the CIA, one CBS executive said, it's a single subject about which his memory has failed. He just can't remember what was going on back then. The Museum of Modern Art was in some official way connected to the government's secret cultural warfare program. Absolutely was. Abstract expressionism Weapon of Cold War, which concluded, this rumor was first examined in 1974 by Ava Cockcroft in a seminal article for Art Form called Abstract Expressionism, Weapon of the Cold War, which concluded, links between cultural Cold War politics and the success of Abstract Expressionism are by no means coincidental. They were consciously forged at the time by some of the most influential figures controlling museum policies and advocating enlightened Cold War tactics designed to woo European intellectuals. Moreover, Cockcroft asserted, in terms of cultural propaganda, the functions of both the CIA cultural apparatus and the Museum of Modern Art's international programs were similar and, in fact, mutually supportive. So here, guys, again, Pollock, all of these guys were probably on the verge of starvation because people didn't like their art because it's garbage art. And then the CIA comes in and says, here's all this money and we're going to make you guys superstars. And, oh, yeah, you're going to change. The result is a change in culture. Right. Says, there is no prima facie evidence for any formal agreement between the CIA and the Museum of Modern Art. The fact is, it simply was not necessary. Enough cash was made available to purchase important paintings by Pollock, Motherwell, and Mata. Thus, as might be expected of a Museum of Modern Art, and particularly one which acknowledged that it held a tremendous moral responsibility toward living artists whose careers and fortunes can be drastically affected by the museum's support or lack of it, was the new generation of American painters brought into its fold. Again, these painters that would have, you know, starved to death potentially or had to get a real job instead of splashing paint on something, putting two, you know, like some of the other artists, they have like two colors on there, like one square red and one square, part of the square is blue, and that's art. That's what this is. It's very intellectual, anti-intellectual to me, and I really cannot stomach abstract expressionism. But here you go. Henry Lucci, again, Skull and Bones, big time Skull and Bones, big time money guy, owner of Time Life, big time. Henry Lucci, in August 1949, Life magazine gave its center page spread to Jackson Pollock, landing the artist and his work on every coffee table in America. Such coverage and Barr's effort to secure it destroys the case for neglect. So lots and lots and lots of money, lots and lots and lots of influential people who had, for example, a magazine that went on every coffee table in America pushing this crap. Is that freedom? Is that freedom to choose what your tastes are? I mean, I obviously grew up way later than this. But the influence that this stuff has on artists of my generation and the ones immediately preceding me, you can't calculate something like that. So this is incredibly influential activities going, even in Western Europe too, obviously. The cultural influence, again, cultural influence means mind, intellectual influence, cannot be surmised. The influence of it cannot be overstated how important this particular information is, because really it changed the world forever. The last section I will read is about movies, Hollywood movies that the Central Intelligence Agency helped, push, helped use to push to propagandize us unwitting Americans. Quote, militant libertists, the phrase which designated a top secret campaign on the part of the Pentagon, the Navy, the National Security Council, and Operations Coordinating Board to insert the theme of freedom into American movies. On Friday, 16 December 1955, a secret gathering was convened by the Joint Chiefs of Staff to discuss how the idea of militant liberty could be exploited by Hollywood. The idea was to create a slogan, a political catchword that most people would have the impression had arisen spontaneously, but which in fact had been intentionally introduced into the culture. In June and July 1956, representatives of the Joint Chiefs of Staff held several meetings in California with a posse of Hollywood figures dedicated to expunging communism: John Ford, Marion Cooper, John Wayne, and Ward Bond. The meetings, which were held in the MGM office of John Ford, lasted up to 6 hours. According to a memo of 5 July 1956, Mr. Wayne, John Wayne, the Duke, that's what they were talking about, Mr. Wayne stated that in his pictures produced by him, Backjack Productions, the militant liberty program would be inserted carefully. To see how this might be done, Wayne invited everyone to his home at 4570 Louise Avenue, Encino, the following evening. After dinner, the movies They Were Expendable and The Quiet Man were shown and studied by Mr. Wayne and Mr. Ford for the manner in which favorable slants for the Navy and free world cultural patterns had been introduced in the two films. Also, they talk about Cornelius Vanderbilt Whitney, and a lot of Skull and Bones guys come from Vanderbilt line as well as the Whitney line. Cornelius allowed the Whitney Trust to be used as a CIA conduit. He was also part of the team involved in formulating a psychological warfare initiative in the National Security Information Agency. Ford, John Ford, the big movie guy, was entirely in sympathy with the idea that the government intelligence agencies should suggest themes for Hollywood audiences and ask them to leave 6 copies of the Militant Liberty booklet with him and send him a dozen more so that he could pass them on to his script writer so that they could learn the nomenclature of the concept. He further requested that a representative of the Joint Chiefs of Staff come to the Pensacola, Florida location of the movie Eagle's Wings for assistance in putting Militant Liberty elements in movies. Movies, like propaganda, trade in fiction. But if this fiction is adroitly manufactured, it will be taken for reality. And again, let's stop there. Adroitly means like secretly, you know. Secretly manufactured, it will be taken for light. How many people do you know that take their cues on reality from Hollywood? Lots. Lots. They think that war movies that they see about World War II or anything are real. They think they're telling you the real history. Our history books, after the last 2 episodes, our history books aren't telling you what's real, right? So this is so important. Movies like propaganda, trade, and fiction, but if this fiction is adroitly manufactured, it will be taken for reality, absolutely. To perform this function well, Hollywood had long understood the need to cut its mythical patterns to suit the prevailing political and social mood. Thus, it had switched from making anti-Bolshevik films in the 1920s and 30s to glorifying Russia as a wartime ally in such films as The North Star, Days of Glory, Songs of Russia, and the notorious Mission to Moscow, which had actually whitewashed the Moscow trials and praised the Russians as defenders of democracy. Laughable. To producing a rash of anti-communist films in the 1950s. The Red Nightmare, The Red Menace, Invasion USA, I Was a Communist for the FBI, Red Planet Mars, Iron Curtain, My Son John, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Walk East on Beacon Street, Walk East on Beacon Street, which was scripted and financed by the FBI, was J. Edgar Hoover's favorite personal film. Their titles, as unconvincing as their plots, these films all revealed a neurotic obsession with the outsider, the unknown, the other. Just as Captain America had switched from battling Nazis to battling communists, the attitude of American films towards Germany changed radically. The vanquished enemy now portrayed as heroic fighters and worthy opponents. Rommel, The Desert Fox, 1952. The Sea Chase, 1955. The Enemy Below, 1957. As Monday's enemies became Tuesday's friends, Hollywood showed how easily it could rip off the good and evil labels from one nation and paste them on to another. So again, you have to ask yourself, you know, what aren't they manipulating now? That's why it's important. It's important to understand history so that we can get a grasp of what's occurring to us right this very moment. And without this proper historical perspective, I think it's just kind of axiomatic. If you don't have a proper understanding of history, it's actually impossible to understand what's happening right now. So now, you know, the CIA has been for a long time, a very long time now, operating as a secret hand, as Francis Stoner Saunders says, an invisible government in culture creation, manufacturing culture. While some elements of our culture are certainly spontaneous, you know, they're certainly not, these people don't control absolutely everything. I mean, if they did control everything, open secrets wouldn't exist, right? But certainly one must question how much of our culture is artificial. How much is the construct of the CIA and other think tank organizations? We already see here in the 50s that the CIA's influence on Hollywood and a great many people, right? They influence a great many things already in the Hollywood. That's what, like, this book, I was kind of hoping there'd be a lot more of this type of information. I know we already got a really good show out of this anyway, but it goes into what the Congress for Cultural Freedom were doing, and those three men I mentioned earlier had, like, events hosting massive culture propaganda events in Paris and in Berlin and all these cities where they're inviting American, like Boston Philharmonic and et cetera, all these big things over there to change culture over there and say, hey, America's a good guy. You know, all that was happening surreptitiously. So their influence is unbelievably important in history and certainly what's going on today. And again, I mentioned already, like people now are basically totally mind controlled by Hollywood. They think that Hollywood films, many people think they're real, especially historical films. Again, I already mentioned that. And certainly the perception of the Central Intelligence Agency is totally distorted by films about the CIA, right? People think that James Bond is just typical. That's what the MI6 is all about, MI5. It's all about James Bond type guys. They're good guys, no matter what, always good guys. When the truth is should be becoming obvious that they're, in fact, not good. So hopefully this leads you to question history, certainly modern American history. I think the last few books should do that as well. Come to your own conclusions about these things. Here is kind of the historical documentation about culture, cultural war, cultural creation. Next week's episode is by a massively influential philosopher called Theodore Adorno, and it's called The Cultural Industry. So tune in for that one. And we will be going into the philosophy of cultural Marxism and how cultural Marxist ideas crept into America to destroy and subvert our culture, which I think it has done quite amazingly. So I'll say again, if you appreciate our work, if you appreciate Open Secrets, if you learn something from this, I know money's getting tight, but please, please, please consider donating to Grand Forks Best Source. And I will be forever indebted myself to Grand Forks Best Source for giving an outlet for this information, because basically no one else is talking about this stuff. No one else. I mean, it's basically us on the internet. I mean, I think there are a couple other places where you can find this stuff, but please support us so we can grow. And you can do that at gfbestsource.com. There's a donate page. Please consider doing it. And if you don't, that's all right. It's, you know, wonderful if you just learn something from here and share and spread this information, because people must learn this stuff. We're going to talk about our last sponsor, which is LifeVantage. Biohack your life with supplements and body care with Stephanie Kornelka and LifeVantage, a science-based company that has dedicated its time to help people reach their health and wellness goals. Products can assist with personal skin and hair care, immune system health, anti-aging solutions, and even pet health. For more information, check out stephk.lifevantage.com. Again, that's stephk.lifevantage.com, or text 701-230-9306 or email skbesthealth@gmail.com. Thank you all again. Once again, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for tuning into this program. Thank you very much for listening to what I have to say. Thank you for hopefully reading these books and thinking about it and applying these concepts. It's very important that we do this. And please, I can also be reached at daniel@realcovidfacts.org. If you want to discuss anything, if you have any questions, if you want to call me all kinds of names, that's all right too. I'll send a nice email back to you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. I love you all. God bless you. And we'll see you next time for the culture industry.